Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. I'm just letting that play a little bit longer today, because that's the last time we'll play it. So I'm just kind of milking it a little bit, because I love that song. I want to thank my friend Jameson Statema, who put that song together for me. Jameson is one of the founders and lead singers of Go Fish. So if you know that band and that ministry, that's him. And I said, give it a whirl. And he sent me one song, and that was it. I said, perfect. Thanks. I also want to thank Paul and Rebecca, the morning team that's been part of this journey with me. It's been a blast. Thanks to Logan, who's been working the board this week. Thanks to Dick Whitworth and Neil Stabem, who said, give it a whack, give it that morning show a try. And I did, and I loved it. And I'm gonna miss you listeners terribly. So my goal was to just get up in the morning and see the face of God before I even looked at myself in the mirror. And it was my desire to help you see the face of God in the morning as you got up and got about your day. And I wanted to point you to Him, and I've always wanted to point you to Him. And God never does anything to you that isn't for you. So everything God does to you is for you. So He's your best friend. He's your Savior. He's your rescuer. He's your redeemer. He's going to be there for you. Jesus says, I am the shepherd, and I know you, and you know my voice. And so just keep in mind that God really loves you, and I have loved being here with you in the morning. It's been great. I'm just going to miss it terribly, but it's going to be really fun to be in the afternoon slot, in the afternoon drive slot, because you got to start your day somewhere and you got to end it somewhere. I'm going to be with you there on the tail end of the day. We're going to be processing what goes on in the day. We're going to have some fun. We're going to have some really lively interviews with some amazing guests that are going to bring levels of spiritual depth that's going to be truly amazing. And honestly, true faith goes into action when there are no answers. And when we don't have answers, we really go into a place of true faith. And troubles in life and challenges in life, they're not a matter of if. They're just a matter of when. And troubles, as you know, will make you better or worse. And troubles and challenges can make you or break you. And I know that the troubles and challenges you have in life, if you're a follower of Christ, will make you better. All right, let's take a little break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk to Adam Holtz from Plugged In. There are a couple movies that I'm very interested in asking Adam about. So when we return, Adam Holtz from Plugged In. It is 9 minutes after the hour. Welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're with me this morning. My guest is Adam Holtz from Plugged In. And Adam, good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Bill. How are you doing?
Well, I'm good. There's a couple of movies coming out this weekend I want to ask you about. The first movie that I'm interested in asking you about is a movie called Bill Gets to Sleep In Monday.
You know, that sounds like a snoozer to me.
All right. The other movie coming out is called Bill is Going to Terribly Miss His Morning Listeners. What have you heard about that movie?
Well, just a little bit here earlier in your show, I actually thought I had tuned in for an Academy Awards broadcast. You were thinking, so I will miss participating with you.
Yeah, Yeah, well, I mean,
lovely, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed Friday morning.
I get it, but I'm on in the afternoons, so starting Monday, so I'll have you on in the afternoon show, and we'll have lots of fun then. And I'm just I'm nervous that I'll be fully awake in the afternoon, and people will go, "He's fully awake. He seems kind of dull."
Well, the good news is I'll be fully asleep. So I'm sharp in the morning and dull in the afternoon. So,
all right. So how does Star Wars, how does it go through, what is it, two or three directors?
Well, nobody really knows for sure. All they know is that they had hired the guys from the Lego movie to direct initially. And, you know, Lucasfilm and Disney play things pretty close to the vest with this, you know, could arguably be called the crown jewel of their many, many, many franchises. But they ended up with Ron Howard, and there was lots of scuttlebutt that the production of the second standalone Star Wars movie, which is Solo, a Star Wars story, that it was a mess. And depending on which critic you read, you can either think, yeah, it kind of was, or no, it's fine. It's exactly what you think it is, which is the backstory on Han Solo for everybody who ever wondered how Han Solo got to be Han Solo.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of it personally? Did you get a kick out of it? Like it? Not so much?
No, I did. And I think expectations are the key. I think lots of people
said,
well, it's not Harrison Ford. I'm like, well, yeah, it's not Harrison Ford. That's obvious. And he's irreplaceable. He's an iconic character. His depiction of Han Solo is one that probably all of us could quote many times over, but if you can let go of that, and it this doesn't have quite the gravitas of the episode movies, or even Rogue One. This is a different kind of rogue story. It shows us basically Han's backstory, and he, it turns out, was something of an orphan. He ends up almost like an indentured servant on his home planet of Corellia, and he and his girlfriend Kira make a break. They try to escape from the crime boss that lords it over them, essentially, and controls their lives. And he gets out, she doesn't, and the movie is about him trying to figure out a way to get back to rescue her. And along the way, he falls in with a guy called Beckett, played by Woody Harrelson, and they're trying to, it's basically a heist movie. They're trying to steal the stuff that enables hyperdrives to work so that Han can get enough money to buy a ship. And the ship, of course, is the Millennium Falcon, owned by Lando Calrissian. And Chewbacca shows up. I thought it was a fun heist movie.
Okay.
And it, as PG-13 movies go, this is, relatively speaking, on the milder end of things. There wasn't as much profanity or as much violence as, say, well, let's go with Avengers Infinity War for another Disney title. I took my 11-year-old son to it, and I didn't really have any problem with that. That's not a blanket endorsement. A little bit of profanity, obviously, some shooting, some violence. But I really liked it. I thought it was fun, and I think going in with expectations in check is the key here.
Yeah. All right, what about Show Dogs?
What about Show Dogs? Boy, what a story this has been. You know, every week there are movies released that, unless you are a true movie buff, they come and go and you don't even know they ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
Show Dogs was set to be one of those movies. This is a kids movie that released 2 weeks ago, and it's about a talking dog named Max, who is a New York City police officer. He gets teamed up with Will Arnett, who plays an FBI agent, and they're trying to bust an animal smuggling ring. They have to go to Las Vegas, and he has to submit to performing in a dog show. And I should say the dogs speak to each other, but the humans can't hear them. So it's a little bit confusing at points who hears what. So it should have been a completely forgettable movie with, you know, just enough doggy toilet humor for us to say, eh, you know, it's not perfect. And then something really weird happened. And I guess in retrospect, it should have been evident to everybody. But as a part of the movie, the dog has to submit to being examined in the dog show, which is, you know, the judges check out their bodies, all the parts of their bodies. and there was a blogger named Tarina Maldonado, I think I'm pronouncing her name right, who was really concerned that Max has to submit to this in order to basically solve the mystery and rescue a panda that has been stolen. And she really felt very strongly that this was a message that unintentionally groomed kids for sexual abuse. Well, at that point, this thing completely blew up. I mean, just exploded. Everybody picked up on her her blog post, to the point that there was a national sexual exploitation organization that came out and basically reiterated what she had said. And within a week, they recut the movie to get rid of some of that offensive material. And we went and saw it again this week, and our current review reflects the cut that's in the movie now. And interestingly, even after all of that, they didn't cut as much as I had expected them to.
Hmm.
So it really was a case study, I think, in unintended consequences. The filmmakers came out and said, this was supposed to be a dumb gag. This was not what we were going for. But I think it's a cautionary tale for everybody. Haha, cautionary tale. You see what I did there?
I did, yeah. I did not go unnoticed.
For, you know, there are layers of interpretation in movies. And we came in for some crit that, you know, we didn't see that layer ourselves. And even after it came up, we were somewhat philosophical and saying, well, yeah, that's there, but it seems pretty clear that wasn't what the filmmakers intended. But so there was quite a bit of hullabaloo on our blog.
With 20 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with me this morning. Adam Holtz is my guest from PluggedIn.com. Adam, what about the movie Adrift?
Adrift. It's a movie that the title tells you pretty much everything you need to know.
Yeah.
This is a story based on a true story. It stars Shailene Woodley. And she plays a character who's sort of a fancy free, you know, free spirit island girl who meets an English guy. They fall in love and they get a gig, if you will, taking a 40-foot yacht 4,500 miles across the Pacific Ocean to Los Angeles, and they're going to be well paid for it. So it seems like a dream come true. They can live their ocean adventure, get paid, have a romance, that sort of thing. Well, as the title indicates, it doesn't go quite like that. They run into a tropical depression, which is not something that you, not just feeling bad in a forest somewhere. That's actually a big storm. And it destroys the boat, and they end up adrift at sea, and it's a survival story. And it's based on a true story, and she's still alive, so that gives you a clue perhaps how it ends up.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is a that kind of survival drama. And the biggest issues here are some pretty intense and realistic violence. The storm does a number on both of them, but especially him. He ends up with a really nasty leg injury that just about does him in. And there's one scene that includes a very brief shot of her without clothes on the front of the boat, and it seems like the purpose of the scene is just to show how beat up she is, because she's got cuts and scars and bruises all over her. You know, that would be probably the biggest content warning here. So by all means, check out our full review, but I'm not sure there's that much more to say, actually.
Mm-hmm.
If you like intense, you know, based on a true story survival tales, this one might scratch your itch, and if being stuck on a boat in the middle of the ocean after being mangled doesn't sound like your idea of a good movie, probably take a pass on this one.
I would be panicked about being adrift without enough sunscreen.
Well, yeah, they get really badly sunburned, and they're dehydrated, and, yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah.
They, it doesn't go well for them.
All right, just with a few minutes remaining, Adam, and this is a little uncomfortable because the nature of this show, and now in its second season on Netflix, the 13 Reasons Why. What should we be forewarned about this? And this is disturbing content and all that. So talk about that if you would.
It's impossible to talk about it without briefly mentioning the first season. Tells the story of a young girl who commits suicide, and she's left these audio tapes to a friend explaining all the influences. And this one kind of goes on from there. There's a trial involving, you know, what has happened to her and who's responsible. And she kind of comes back as a ghost-like character and speaks to one of the main characters. Whereas the first one at least made the argument that it was about, you know, a cautionary message against teen suicide. And lots of people said, yeah, maybe, but it seems like it also could promote it. It's got a lot of problems. This one just feels like teen drama run amok.
Okay.
In addition to suicide, you can pretty much pick your teen issue. Sex, drugs, assault. There are multiple rapes in this series. It's a lurid show.
Okay.
And it almost feels like they said, hey, let's take this template and blow it out with every controversial issue in the most controversial way that teens could possibly get into. And so I think, if possible, it's even more problematic than the first season. I think you could at least make the case that the first season was trying to be a cautionary message. This just feels like a shameless, gratuitous play for eyeballs. And I would say, really, there's no reason to tune in for this one. And if you're concerned about what teens are going through, our website and there are other youth ministry-oriented websites out there that can keep you in touch with that information without having to expose yourself to the graphic, you know, M-rated content that we see here.
Mm-hmm. Adam, Logan, who's running the board this morning, almost sprained his fingers typing the message, Ask Adam about Incredibles 2, which comes out June 14th.
Well, at this point, Logan probably knows as much as I do.
Okay.
I've seen the trailers. We have not seen the film yet. You know, sequels are always, they're always dicey. You know, you have Toy Story, which sort of maybe defied the norm and made sequels as good as the original. I'll hold my breath and hope that one of my favorite Pixar movies gets a similarly awesome treatment. But you'll be able to come to Plugged In and check out our review the week that comes out.
Mm-hmm. All right, Adam, thank you so much. Thank you for being such a great guest on the Early Morning Late Show. This is our last episode, but I will certainly look forward to having conversations with you in the afternoons coming up starting next week.
Definitely.
All right, have a great day, Adam.
Thanks,
God bless you. Yep, 26 minutes after the hour, we'll take a little break and then hear from Breakpoint. It is 31 minutes after the hour. We're heading towards the last half hour of the Early Morning Late Show. And can I just gush on my listeners? Can I just gush on you? Can I just say thank you? Can I just say I love you? Can I just say thank you for listening? Thank you for supporting me every day. I try to come in and roll the ball down the middle of the alley, hoping to knock over as many pins as possible. I know there's a 5-10 split out there somewhere, but thank you so much for being so supportive of me and the work that I've been doing here. I've loved it. I know I can't make everybody happy because I'm not chocolate. We'll take a short break and be back.
Nobody's perfect. Nobody makes it through life without hurting others and getting hurt in the process. Relationships are messy. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. If you have a teen in your family, you know what it feels like to be hurt, disrespected, or ignored. But you have a choice in the middle of all of this. You can love your kids even when you feel like they don't deserve it. Like I said, relationships are messy. And I've learned over the years that if I walk away from someone every time they offend me, I allow their actions to determine the future of our relationship. That's not what any parent wants. This time around, choose to show love, even when the kids don't deserve it.
There's much more encouragement for parents from Mark Gregston online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
It's It is 24 minutes till the top of the hour. Yesterday, I had a chance to have a nice conversation with Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley from the Institute of Faith Work and Economics. She's a very busy person and having a very busy schedule, so I was able to chat with her yesterday, and I'm going to air that now today in our last segment of the Early Morning Late Show. And I don't know if we're going to be squeezed out of time towards the end, so I just want to make sure you hear it from me that God loves you and I love you, and I just want to make sure that you know how much I appreciate being here in this studio and part of your morning. So I'll go into that interview, but I want to say that what I asked Ann was, what is the Christian's understanding or perspective on income inequality?
I absolutely think so. This is really a topic that is so near and dear to my heart. I've been writing about it and thinking about it for a couple of years now, and I think for Christians, it's a really unique and nuanced approach that we must have because we're called to care for the poor. And so I think in the modern American political debate, income inequality tends to get wrapped into a conversation about poverty. And in that wrapping together of those concepts, I think we tend to view them as the same thing, mm-hmm. which means they need to be stopped, they need to be obliterated, we need to use policy whenever we can to kind of roll back the tide. And so I think that the first thing there is a mistake. I don't think that poverty and inequality are the same thing. So poverty means a lot of things, but materially it means that you don't have the opportunity to work, to be included in market trade, and thus don't have a means, i.e. an income, to provide for yourself and your family. And so when you're poor, it's very hard to do things like get water, get shelter, get health care, care for your family, grow your community, be involved in your church. Everything is harder. And as Scripture tells us, it's very clear that we're to care for the poor and we're to try to help the poor escape poverty permanently, if mm-hmm. possible. Not everybody can do that. But so that's one thing. Inequality is different. Inequality just means some people may have more income than other people in a society. And what I like to bring to the topic is that there's nothing necessarily unbiblical or wrong with that. And that kind of tends to be a bit of a shock statement because you think, well, you know, Bill Gates has all this money. In fact, Jeff Bezos, I just read this last Friday, he has become the first centrabillionaire, which I had to look up what that word meant. And it's the first person whose net worth is over $100 billion. So he's the richest person on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So is the fact that Jeff Bezos is a lot richer than me a problem? And I would also say it depends, but not necessarily. So if Jeff Bezos is working hard, he's innovating, discovering, creating, then in a market economy, he only gets rich when we pay him for those services. So by definition, customers are saying, hey, good job with the Amazon thing.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing, right? So that's a good thing. In fact, it's win-win, it's mutual, and that is the solution to poverty. Now, when inequality can become a problem is when people can exploit and plunder and steal and get richer that way. So I think that's the nuance that we require when we, as Christians, have this conversation.
Yeah, and how many people does Jeff Bezos employ? I mean, I employ no one, and I'm only worth like $90 billion, so... What I mean, how many people does he employ?
Well, kudos to you for that accomplishment.
Thank you, by the way.
He employs, right, thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And I love your question because I want to dissect it a little bit.
Okay.
It's not even the number of employees that Amazon has, which is important and good, but it's take one step back from that. So Amazon has employees and they work, let's just take one aspect of Amazon. They work in a large storage warehouse facility. In fact, my neighborhood is supposed to be getting one and people are very excited. I don't know if it will happen, but they're very excited about that. So that's going to create a lot of jobs, right? People get to work in that storage facility. They have more opportunities. And it's good for Amazon because it means Amazon has so much demand for its stuff that they need another facility. But I think what we miss is it's not just the jobs created by Amazon. It's the secondary jobs, which is all the stuff that's in that warehouse, most of it Amazon doesn't make.
Mm-hmm.
So the books that you buy, right, the pencils that you buy, the computer printers, the sleeping bags, all the stuff that's in those warehouses are produced by hundreds of millions of different types of workers around the globe. So I love the Amazon example because it's really a coordination story of hundreds of millions of people coming together in a very kind of uncoordinated way, right? Like nobody's driving this process. Adam Smith called this the invisible hand. So Amazon is not just good because it creates the primary jobs. I would say it's the secondary jobs, if you want to think of it that way, that employ lots of people. But I would go one step further and say jobs are always and everywhere a cost on the economy. And what do I mean by that? Because we herald jobs as the best thing ever, and unemployment's at an all-time low in the United States, and those are good things to be excited about. But think about what it requires to have a job. If I'm an employer and I can hire you, it means that I have excess capital. I have enough money to give you a job. For you, for me, you are a cost to me. So jobs can only happen, and low levels of unemployment can only happen when there's a lot of wealth circulating in the economy. So jobs are a cost, but they're a sign of a robust, thriving economy. So I actually think the biggest value that Amazon adds is not in the jobs. It's in the very easy way that they've provided for us as consumers to get our hands on stuff that it would be much harder 50 years ago for us to get our hands on. That's the freedom of Amazon. That's the benefit.
So, Anne, if I look at Jeff Bezos, I think his income is so huge. I don't have a problem with his income. And why should I as a Christian?
Yeah, and you know what? You don't. I don't. I don't think there's a biblical reason to have a problem with his income. But I think a lot of people do have a problem with his income. So one of this, I think, is just cultural. And, you know, I have two little kids, and I have to say that even in the the Disney cartoons that they watch, which is seemingly benign, who's the evil corporate, you know, the evil villain is the evil corporate guy. In many of these, even like what we're showing to our little tiny children. So I think the cultural narrative is rich corporate executives are bad. No, they're just humans, right? Humans are sinful and fallen, and that applies to all humans, whether they're in a firm or a church or a government. It doesn't matter. So I think, you know, what we have to ask for as Christians is that the only way Jeff Bezos is allowed to get this kind of wealth is if he's serving other people, not exploiting them. And if you look at the record of human history, most people for most of the time have been exploited.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really amazing when you look at the data there. It's not really until the Industrial Revolution where ordinary people start getting rich. But before that, there were a few people, and they were monarchs and kings and queens and tyrants. They had all the money. The rest of the population starved and died early.
Yeah.
Right? Of preventable diseases. So
yeah.
I think as Christians, I would go one step further and say we should celebrate entrepreneurs who do these things for us because they save our lives.
I agree. And I remember when I was a kid watching cartoons, I think it was Scrooge McDuck that would, you know, take a dive into a pile of gold coins in his living room. I was always a little jealous of that. But
Ebenezer Scrooge, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Let me take a break, Anne. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Anne Bradley from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back. I'm having a delightful conversation with Dr. Anne Bradley from the Institute of Faith, Work, and Economics. We're talking about income inequality. And Anne, I get the point about entrepreneurs. We should celebrate them because they do great things for our economy and capitalism and all that, if you think that's a good thing. Others don't think that's a good thing. But let's talk a little bit about cronyism. And that's a word that when that gets bantered around, nobody likes that word. Explain that word and say why we shouldn't like that.
Sure. So in the economic literature, we originally called this rent seeking, which I kind of like because what it means is seeking a rent, seeking a benefit, seeking a gain. Now, there's nothing wrong with seeking a benefit, right? We all do that all the time, right? We want to have leftovers. We want to have extra money in our bank account at the end of the month. We want to have extra time. So there's nothing wrong with that. I think the rent seeking narrative, which we now call cronyism, is this idea that we're not seeking normal profit opportunities through entrepreneurship. I like to call cronyism political entrepreneurship. So what it means is, and it tends to be larger companies, and the reason it tends to be larger companies is because they have more capital and they have more political sway. It's exactly a company that hires or employs thousands of people that can go to K Street and kind of make relationships with people on the Hill and, you know, say things like, hey, you have to bail me out because I'm too big to fail,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And when they make that claim, legislators get scared. Why do they get scared? Because people don't want to hear about job losses and things like that. So they ask their government to protect them. But the problem with all of this stuff is that it protects people who are making bad stewardship decisions. That's how I want us to think about it. Mm. When GE or GM or whoever, you know, Solyndra, Enron, there's many, many, many we could list. When they make bad business decisions, whether they're mistaken business decisions or whether they're corrupt, we want them to suffer economic losses rather than economic profits. Why? Because the loss is the feedback from the consumers. You did it wrong. You're lying, you're cheating, you're stealing, whatever it is. And then they have to redirect. They either have to get better or they have to stop. And that's what we want because, again, we live in a world of scarcity. These resources they commandeer are scarce. And so the problem with saying, you know, GM making all these bad business loans pre-financial crisis and or Bear Stearns, any of them, right, and going to Congress and saying, you have to save us, you have to save us. I don't want my employees to lose a job. But we can, as human beings, identify with that. Nobody wants to see innocent employees losing their jobs. But the problem is that not allowing that company to pay the penalty for its bad mistakes means they'll keep making the mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So think about having a child. I have an 8-year-old, and he's starting to do homework and take tests and all this stuff. And I want him to do his very best. But if he comes home and gives me his homework, and I do it for him every night, he will never learn integrity. He will never learn to follow the rules. He will learn to cheat. He will learn to rely on me to do things for him.
Yeah, but he'll
and
get
so
excellent grades.
Well, he might.
Trust me, he will.
You know. But you see, I mean, the way we parent our children, the same principle needs to apply here. So as sad as it is for the employees when GM goes under, in a market thriving economy, thriving market economy, those employees have the best possible chance of getting hired somewhere else. And don't, as employees, don't we all want to work for somebody who has the long run success model in mind and not short run corrupt gains?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really benefit the employees to be maintained in that type of company. So I think that's really the problem with cronyism. And here's one more thing, if I can say this.
Yeah.
I think once everybody starts to do it, you get what I call a culture of cronyism. And so you say, well, GM does it, and, you know, all these other people do it, so I have to do it. Because if they're doing it and I don't do it, I can't compete. So this is the problem with cronyism. It kind of corrodes the culture of entrepreneurship. True entrepreneurship is, I have an idea, I think I know what consumers want in this idea, and I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I'm taking a risk. And there's never a promise of being a billionaire or even mm-hmm. limited success, but you have to work hard for the customer. And I think cronyism makes it easy to ignore the customer. That's mm-hmm. not what we want.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about we're created in God's image. God gives every one of us gifts. So if that's the case, income inequality is going to be obvious, right? Because I have so much fun watching LeBron James work. And he just signed a contract with Nike for $500 million. Obviously, he has gifts that not a lot of people have.
Right. Yeah. Diversity is God-given. I think that's the way we have to approach it. Diversity is God-given. We are all unique. We are all – there's never been a you that's ever walked the planet. That's a beautiful thing. It makes you special. It makes all of us special. It means you have something unique to offer. And – I mean, like, as you're saying, there's a lot of basketball players, but there's very few who have that level of talent and have to work very, very hard to cultivate that talent. And they're rewarded only because people like to watch basketball.
Right.
The day that people stop liking basketball, then this is not a valuable skill. So this is really driven by consumers. And
right.
So as you say, I think diversity is the name of the game. It gives us a way to create wealth because I'm good at some things, you're good at something else, and so we can trade. And entrepreneurs, their job in a market society is to tap into these unmet needs of consumers and to redirect scarce resources to higher values. And mm-hmm. so when entrepreneurs do that, they're rewarded. And, you know, this is kind of what we all have always called the American dream, which is anybody can make it. And I think cronyism, again, to go back to that for a second, really harms that because the mom and pop, you know, the little entrepreneur who just started something has a harder chance of making it big. And we don't want a society that kind of thwarts that. So I think inequality is not necessarily a bad thing. What we want, that this is why I said at the beginning of the segment, we need to separate poverty from inequality. Because mm-hmm. again, while Jeff Bezos is far richer than I am, and I'm not, you know, kind of, I don't consider myself rich, but in real terms, all of us who are listening to the radio are probably rich. We're certainly rich in global terms.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. So Jeff Bezos is richer than me, but he and I still we can both get on an airplane, right? We can both go to the doctor and get an antibiotic when we have strep throat. So in that regard, he and I are the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we want. I'm not so worried about the gap in income. What I'm worried about is people who are poor. What kind of society do we need to allow them to permanently escape poverty? That's what we care about because then – you know, then the gap doesn't matter as much. What we want is this income mobility. So the poor, they may fall on hard times. They may have bad situations, but they can get out of it because it's a dynamic, fluid economy that provides opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And we just have about a minute left, so I'm going to ask a tough question. As Christians, we want to serve the poor. We want to help make a difference. But then we also want to invest in people and help them to create their own opportunities. Jesus says, you'll always have the poor with me. What about as Christians have the mindset to invest in people and help them in their dreams as well?
I would say this starts first and foremost with the family. We need, you know, strong families, because that's what we're all born into, to cultivate and inspire and lift up the dignity of each child. Because as I said, each person on the earth has something to contribute. So mm-hmm. I think that's where it starts. And then it starts with communities and opportunities for people to, as my favorite economist, Deirdre McCloskey, says, give it a go. You know, we want ordinary people to be able to give it a go, which whether that means going to college or starting a business or being an apprentice. And I think we can recapture this. We can reclaim it. We've lost it a little bit. It's becoming much more expensive for ordinary people to go to college. It's becoming much more expensive to start a business. But we can unroll that or roll it back, I should say. And I think this is the best way we can provide for the poor. But one last thing I'll say is I think the church is the place for support of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we need to empower churches to take care of the poor in their communities. And I think we're losing this a little bit, too.
Yeah.
But again, we can recapture it. So there's still reasons for lots of hope.
Yeah, indeed. Ann, thank you so much for coming on to the show, and I hope you have a wonderful day and a great weekend.
Thanks, you too, Bill.
All right. Yeah, we'll take a very short break and be back in just a minute. Thanks so much to all my guests that made the last episode of the Early Morning Late Show so much fun. I have absolutely loved being here in this chair, and I will miss you in the morning. I'm trusting God in the next step. God says, don't worry. He's got a master plan. The thing is, you have to recognize that He is the master. God bless you in your day. I'm not going anywhere. I'm back Monday at 3. Just probably be a little bit better rested, but I'll be there for you at 3 o'clock starting Monday. God bless you. Thank you so much. Like my mom always says, we've got today with hope for tomorrow. I'll see you Monday. You are one of 42 million traveling this weekend. Please be safe. And if you're just sticking around this weekend, have a very blessed weekend. And I will see you next Tuesday. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.